You have to thank everyone for coming. First of all, with regard to giving a reference for someone for Shidduchim, and this is something that we all play this role at one point or another. People turn to us, and it's a very sensitive issue in terms of what we're allowed to say, what we should say, what we're not allowed to say, we should not say, what we are allowed to say and have to say. There's a rule from the Chofetz Chaim. We all know that the Chofetz Chaim dedicated himself to the issue of speech. His magnum opus, perhaps, is Shmirat HaLashon, the Chofetz Chaim. And obviously, a lot is in the balance when we speak in general, and certainly when we are called upon as a reference for someone for Shidduchim. So the Chofetz Chaim came up with the following rule. And if these pages ever make it to you, and I apologize if I'm a little late with them, I didn't realize, I thought that we would put it out and everyone would just take. He says the following. If there's a piece of information, and our response to that information would be, if I only had known, then I'll read to you his language. He says the following. Had I known about this deficiency, I would not have agreed to go out with this person in the first place. Now the Chofetz Chaim does not give us specific guidelines. So I have here a sefer called The Code of Jewish Conduct. Anyone who wants to see it could come up and see it later. And if you'll take a look on page 374, which is the first page in your handout, he has calculated five categories of deficiencies which he calls serious enough such that we would be required to offer this information even if we weren't asked up front. Meaning that these deficiencies, you'll see it here on the bottom of page 374 going on to page 375, in his analysis would fit into the Chofetz Chaim's category, which you'll see at the bottom of the next page, which is, it didn't come out in the photocopy, it should say on the bottom 376, and then on the right side 377. So if you look on 376, and he bolds it, it's about five lines up from the bottom of the page, had he known about this deficiency, he would not have agreed to the shidduch in the first place. And let's just very quickly go through these categories. And we have here two categories which have to do with religious background, religious observance. Again, this is a guide for Orthodox people. One is immodesty, which in the Hebrew is called pritzut. And the other is, which is even more extreme, on the bottom of your left column on the first page, 374, which is called apikarsis, which means a denial of the faith. Now this issue about denial of the faith, which is called apikarsis or kthira, requires an entire study on its own. I mean, you all know that the Rishon back 1,000 years ago who made a breakthrough in this area and decided to enumerate those basic principles of the faith is none other than the Rambam. And what's that called? The Yud Gimel Ikrei Hadas, the 13 Yesodim Yesodei Hadas. And although there's been so much critique of the Rambam, for example, Albo reduced it to 3 principles, there were other Rishonim who wanted to expand it beyond the 13, but nevertheless, the Rambam in this area has solely won the day. I mean, it's historically, it's very remarkable In many areas of halacha, the Rambam is contested until this day. Of course, Sfaradim are more inclined to accept the Rambam because the Shulchan Aruch accepts the Rambam in more cases than you'd like to think. The Ashkenazim are a little bit less inclined to accept the Rambam in certain cases. But when it comes to Ikrei Adas, the fundamentals of the faith, the Rambam has won the day. It's very remarkable historically how that happened. In fact, if you're familiar with the Pizmon, that liturgical poem that we read, Yigdal, that itself, which was written hundreds of years after the Rambam, is in a quintessential form a reflection or a reformulation of the Rambam's 13 principles of faith.
The Rizal doesn't say that though.
Again, you have to understand that the Rambam has become, for almost all of Jewry, the final word on this issue.
Presently, they were burning his books for like 100 years.
No, but on this issue, that's again, we don't have time to discuss why they burnt the books of the Rambam. It's open to there's a again, this is what I'm telling you in a nutshell requires 100 hours of study.
Sorry.
But just take, you know, just trust me on this one, okay? You have to trust that I'm giving you the fundamentals of the faith. The Rambam has won the day. So according to this presentation, if you know of an individual and you're being called upon as a reference for that individual, and that individual in your absolute knowledge, again, you can't exaggerate, you have to be absolutely certain, blah blah blah, and all the rules and regulations which we discussed in the past would apply, that this person denies one or more of the principles of the faith, that puts them into this not so positive category called an apikoros. For example, Tchiyat HaMeitim, the belief in the resurrection, is one of the Rambam's 13. Yeah, that too is a long discussion. Just 1 minute. Again, I have a lot to say to you tonight, so give me a little time to develop a thesis here. Pritzut, well, what is pritzut? Immodest behavior, what does that mean? For example, if I were to tell you about someone that he's been convicted of immorality, of having an adulterous relationship, that would fit under pritzut, would it not? But if I told you about someone else, that they exposed their knees, and I'm talking about men and women here, okay? Because there are laws of tzniut for men as well, would that make a person a parutz or prutzum? If I told you about someone that they're not careful about the laws of yichud, which means that one man is not allowed to be alone in a room, a locked room with another woman, unless it's his wife, and this person is lax or lenient about, would that make him into a parutz? 1,000 questions that arise. The next category is illness. Well, there are physical illnesses and there are psychological disorders. There are people who have gone through psychotic, you know, psychiatric help. Okay? And what about someone who has a recurrence of the flu? Right? Or someone who gets, you know, who gets, what's it called when it affects the throat? Strep. And they have to take antibiotics. You know, let's say during the course of an average winter, they get affected by strep 3 times a winter. You know, 5 times a winter. At what point do you... He has here in his list epilepsy. That's a pretty serious illness. Diabetes? Well, I'm not sure. You know, a lot of people have diabetes and it's under control. Depression? Well, that's primary. That's really up there. Now, when he talks about infertility, that boggles the mind. How do you know about someone that they're infertile? Very difficult to know that. Even the physicians today have trouble categorically establishing that someone cannot have children. And then, what about all sorts of other methods that, thank God, we have in today's science that people can have children? So I don't know exactly how you're going to define this. Adoption. Also, you know what I mean? Let's put a bad dukes here and fight him off on this one. I don't know. Is that absolutely critical? Well, I guess a person would like to know whether they're going out with someone who's adopted or not. You know, do they have Jewish origin, non-Jewish origin? You know, people might be curious about that. But I'm not sure exactly how you define in an objective, absolute way what's a deal breaker, what fits under the Chafetz Chaim's category called, had I known about this deficiency, I never would have considered the Shidduch in the first place. What I would suggest, as a general rule, and again I'm taking issue with the good Rabbi Yitzhak Silver over here, so you'll have to paskin on this one. It's your call. I would suggest the following. Let's leave this list on the side. It's very good to be exposed to this list, and I'm not wasting your time by sharing it with you. Keep it in your back pocket. But my feeling is that the general rule should be that if someone calls on you for a reference, there are two sentences that should come out of your mouth right up front. The first is, how well do you know the person? Okay? And the second question, and the answer to the second question can depend on the answer to your first question, is, what do you want me to tell you about that person? Try to get a feel for what kind of issues or questions are they curious about. And, you know, maybe they can give you a little bit of a sense. I'm not telling you they're going to give you an overview point by point. This is what I have to know, and this is what I don't have to know. But every situation is so different, and there are so many variables that come to play. Try to get a sense of what they absolutely have to know. If they ask you very specific questions, then the law is, be as truthful as you can. Never to exaggerate, always to answer to the point. You have in front of you, as we discussed in the past, a very delicate balance between two great mitzvahs. One mitzvah is to help someone, you know, to follow the footsteps of God and create it and get a couple together that they can get married. Have that in mind. But on the other hand of the scale is lo tamen al dam riecha. Don't push something which could devastate a person's life. If you know something that's absolutely critical about someone in these areas, and you have reason to believe that they would want to know about this, don't let them find out after it's too late. The Gemara tells us in Masechta Gittin that a couple that ends up in divorce after marriage is hamizbeach mordel of divorce. It's not a good thing. It's a very, very critical piece of information that you have, and you have to offer it. Okay. I'll take a few questions now and comments, because I want to really start a new topic which should be on your page 2, or maybe it would be your page 3. I don't know. How do you have it divided up? Correct. Page 2. Okay?
Is it in Hebrew or in English?
It's in Hebrew. It should say on it, Gadol HaShalom. Okay, then?
My only question was originally, okay, let's say you're being asked about someone who you know is a Shomer Shabbos and a Torah abiding Jew.
Right.
What about Yechus?
I'm in the middle of asking. I didn't really ask my question. So I see these are important subject matters for either one to have brought up, the person asking or the person answering. But what if it's not a Shomer Shabbos Jew, or he's already considered not Bikurus? So to say, well, he's not Bikurus, is kind of defeating the purpose. Maybe it's a good pair if they're both. I don't know.
Yeah. I was just addressing, you know, two Orthodox Jews. You know, he and she. Again, the rules go haywire if they're not Orthodox. You know, and then rack your brains to figure out what is an absolute deal breaker. You know, for a non-observant Jew, I don't know. I would think that certain levels of these five categories, are they five? Just to count them up again.
Yeah.
Are applicable maybe in a slightly different form. You know, apikursis I don't know about, but even there might be a certain red line for anyone. For example, if you know about this individual that they stand at the forefront of an anti-Israeli political movement. Do you understand what I'm saying? What I would call a self-hating Jew. Again, we can debate this from now till doomsday, and all these issues about freedom of expression for teachers in schools are right now being debated in the courts here in Israel. But be that as it may, I think that that might be apikoursis from the perspective of a Jew who is at least a self-identifying Jew, a proud Jew, and you hear about someone who is out there demonstrating, you know, and organizing demonstrations against Israel, you know, that might be a piece of information that even a conservative or reformed Jew or a Reconstruction Jew might just want to know about. I don't know. I don't know enough about Reconstructionist Judaism. I would like to introduce our next topic within a topic, and that is peace and harmony. And you may ask me, well, wait a minute. There was dating, there was marriage, there was shalom bayis. Why are you jumping the gun? And there may be many reasons for that, but one of which is, I think, if we have a concept in our minds of what peace and harmony, the mechanics of marriage in the positive sense, then I think it's going to have a tremendous impact on the whole question of how to go about searching and finding a marriage partner. First and foremost, I want to introduce to you a piece of an article. This is just a part of an article by Rabbi Chaim Shmulevitz, Zichrono Livracha. He was a great genius. He was the Rosh Yeshiva, the Mir Yeshiva, both in Shanghai, out in China during the war days, and here in Yerushalayim after the war. He introduces the concept of peace with the pasuk Hashem oz li'amo yitein, Hashem yivarech et amo v'shalom. That when we talk about oz, when we talk about the power of Almighty God in bestowing a great gift upon His people, the people of Israel, then what the pasuk has to share with us is Hashem yivarech et amo v'shalom. The greatest peace, the greatest prize we can hope for, the greatest gift we can hope for is peace. And here, the Rosh Yeshiva calls our attention to a Maimer Chazal, which is quoted by Rashi al HaTorah. There's a very strange pasuk that describes a dialogue between Abraham and Sarah. Avram turns to his wife and he says, Hine no yadati ki isha yifas tor at. Now I have become aware of the fact that you are a beautiful woman. What does that mean, now I become aware? Keep in mind the historical perspective. We're talking about a couple that's been married for decades. We're talking about a couple that's now on its way out of Eretz Canaan because of the famine, down to Mitzrayim, and obviously there's a lot of fear on Avram's part and Sarah's part that she'll be taken away because of her beauty. But Chazal add another piece to this, to the perspective here. Rashi says it's in the second paragraph in the name of the Medrash, Ad achshav lo hikir ba mitoch tzniut shebishnei. This is an amazing description on the part of Chazal of one of the patriarchal marriage relationships. That tzniut means that a man looks at a woman and sees her tzniut. Did Avraham Avinu not know that he was married to, according to Chazal, one of the four most beautiful women that ever lived? Could he have been unaware of that? But maybe beauty should be defined under two different categories. There's one beauty that's absolutely skin deep. It's physical. It's external. It jumps out at you. You can't miss it unless you're blind. And that beauty lends itself to something called tzniut. And tzniut engenders a second category of beauty, an inner beauty. We're going to talk about this over and over again. To what extent is physical beauty a prerequisite for a good, happy marriage? How often do we hear any of the following comments? You know, I've gone out with this girl. Again, I'm going to say from the man's side, you could say from the girl's side. I think it's even more relevant and common from the girl's side, by the way. But anyway, that's a different debate. We don't want to get into that whole thing because we'll really be fighting this out till death do us part. But I'm going to represent the male population at this moment. And, you know, wait a minute. I went out with her twice. I went out with her three times already. She's not that good looking. And how often does it happen that if for the right reasons he continues to pursue the relationship, after the fourth date he comes back and he says, you know, she's not bad looking. And after the fifth date he's saying she's quite good looking. And by the sixth date he's saying she's absolutely beautiful. I'm telling you, my friends, this is not uncommon. How often do you find that a man marries a woman based on physical beauty and physical attraction, and somehow time takes its toll and the years roll along and we're just not as beautiful at the age of 40, 50, and 60 as we were at the age of 18 and 22. So does that mean that the marriage should just go down the tubes? So Chazal tell us that mitoch tzniut shaitaba, he did not focus his attention, Avraham Avinu, on the physical external beauty of Sarah. But now it became relevant. Because where was he going down to now? Mitzrayim. And what do the Mitzrayim look for? They look for physical beauty. And in fact, Sarah Imenu was taken by the head honcho, by the Melech of Mitzrayim, and so the whole story ensues. But the relationship between Avram and Sarah has to be described in a very idealistic way. For decades and decades, they lived together in perfect harmony. And yet, and this is the paradox of it all, you remember Avram Avinu is 100 years old. He's sitting out in front of the Ohel, Kechol Hayom. It's hot and it's 3 days after his Mila never. 100-year-old man goes through Mila. And he gets visited by three, shall we call them, travelers, nomads, hodos, I don't know who they are, but they turn out to be Malach Yasharis. And the Malach turns to Avraham Avinu and says, Ayei Sarah Ishtecha. Where is your wife Sarah? And she's in the Ohel. If you take a look on the third paragraph, Gemara Bab Metzia, the second line, Yodim Hayu Malachi Ashari Soymenu Heichan Hoysa. They knew exactly where she was. So does that mean I should ask a question when I know the answer? I don't like when students do that. Why did they answer? El Hodia. They wanted to tell him, Lahodio, notify Avram, take notice, Shetznua Hoysa, that she's an Isha Tznua. Why? Do they have to notify Avram Avinu? Kidei Lechavav Al Bala, to increase the endearment of a wife to her husband. Now, wait a minute, they've been married for decades. They're no youngsters. I mean, he's 100, she's 90. But no, the Torah wants to teach us for all eternity, Kidei Lechavav Al Bala. You see, Chazal teach us, and the Balei Musar emphasize this, that we have to be careful for the what's called Dake Dakus. The human psyche is so complex, so sensitive. And on the ideal level, we have to be sensitive to all these feelings, nuances of feelings. In the context of the glorious, harmonious marriage between Avram and Sarah, the Malachim have to ask Avram Avinu, and this is going to be recorded for all eternity, in the Book of Books, Ayei Sarah Ishtecha, Kedei Lechav Val Baila, to add, to enhance a relationship that's on very solid ground. And yet this is what we have to do. That's how great harmony is, peace, Hashem Yivarech et Amo V'Shalom. And if you look at the next paragraph, he says that in the case of Yaakov Avinu, he had two wives, Leah and Rachel, and the Torah says that Yaakov loved Rachel. What's the language of the pasuk? Rachel mi Leah. What does that mean? Vayehov es Yaakov es Rachel mi Leah. How would you translate those words? Anyone?
More than
Leah. Well, what does that imply? Did Yaakov love Leah? He did. And yet, the Torah tells us that Leah was a snua. She was hated. How do we reconcile the two? On the one hand, the Torah testifies that Yaakov loved Leah. And on the other hand, he hated Leah. How does love and hate coexist at the same time? But the Archaim HaKadosh says that in a very deep, subtle way, Yaakov Avinu had a little bit, a nuance, something that you and I couldn't even tell, couldn't be aware of. Leah herself was unaware of it. Only HaKadosh Baruch Hu knew that she was a snua. Yaakov Avinu was unaware of it. In his own evaluation, he thought he loved Leah the same way, identical to the way he loved Rachel. He wasn't aware of the nuance of the difference. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu was. And when Leah gives birth to her third child, who remembers the third child's name? Right? Levi. Aaron, you give me all the answers tonight, but I was hoping to get other people involved. Oh, no, it's okay. I didn't think I was asking that. You know, I didn't. Again, Aaron is a rocket scientist, but I thought everyone would know that if you count Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, you know, you get the answer to my question, who's the third child? Now, why was Levi called Levi?
His name sounds like the heart, Lev.
No, that would be if it was Levi with a vet. But it's Levi with a vav. Levi with a vav is a short form of the word livui, lilavot. Hapam yilaveh oti ba'ali. And Chazal say that Levi cemented, with his birth, cemented the relationship between Yaakov and Levi's mother, Leah. Says the Rosh Yeshiva, we're going to find later on that the Levium, Shevet Levi, is chosen to replace the Bechoros of Klal Yisrael, the firstborn, in the Avoda of the Beis HaMikdash. Why? And there are many, many answers to this question about Shevet Levi, but the Rashi has a very unique answer. Levi personifies Shalom Bayis, marital harmony. Because it's Levi through his birth. Again, we're not talking about something conscious on the part of Levi. He was just born. You know, he popped his head out. That's it. Ich bin du. Like my new grandson who was born two and a half hours ago. Right? In Shari Tzedek Hospital. They haven't met him yet. Okay. I'm saving the Shekhiano. You know, for after the Shiach, they'll let me in at that hour. But so Levi just, he was born. That's it. But nevertheless, his birth was a cause. How often the Chazal see that when someone is a cause, even if he's a human cannibal, but if he's a cause, his status and his essence represents a certain midah, a certain attribute. And in this case, Levi's birth represents the attribute of shalom, of peace, of solidifying a love relationship, which is missing something that you and I, as human beings, cannot even discern. It's beyond our perception, but Levi closed the gap. Hapam yilavelti ishi, and therefore, because he cements that relationship, he personifies harmony, shalom, Hashem yivarech et amo v'shalom, and therefore, Levi is going to be that shevet that's going to be in charge of the avoda, the service in which we create a harmonious, love, intimate relationship between Knesset Yisrael, the people of Israel, and HaKadosh Baruch. If you put this on the side now and turn to the next page, I want to study with you a Rambam. Some of you may know I'm a big fan of the Rambam. The Rambam has codified the laws of Ishut, which means marriage. 99% of Hilchot Ishut are technical, legal codes that determine when a person has to get married, how to effectuate the marriage. They determine the rights of a woman in marriage, the responsibilities of a husband in marriage. But I would say one percentage of the Rambam of Hilchos Ishus addresses the question of marital harmony. And that's the Rambam that I want to study with you. This is at the end of the 15th chapter of Hilchos Ishus. In Halacha Yud Chet, the Rambam speaks about the Midah of Tzniut. He says a lot about Tzniut, but that's for a different discussion. One thing I just want to call to your attention, and that is, he warns a married woman to be very, very careful about any sort of intimacy with close relatives, male close relatives, obviously, of her husband. Interesting. And the Rambam says, "Kidei shelo yavar alav ruach kina." We may expand this beyond relatives because the Rambam uses the word mikoravav ubnei beito. There may be a circle of people that come in and out of the house that are very common because of a very deep friendship. And the Rambam warns a woman to be very careful because she may incur the jealousy of her husband. And that is to be seen in the context of a long halachic discussion called a sota. And a sota is a woman who had what's called kinui and stira. Kinui means when her husband is jealous, suspecting her of having an intimate relationship with another man, and he warns her not to go in a private place with that man. That's called kinui. Stira is if she violates his warning. But what I want to start with and call your attention to is halacha yutes. The Rambam writes the following: V'chein tzivu chachamim. Sheyeh Adam, he's talking about a husband, mechabed et ishto yeter migufo. A husband has to respect his wife more than he respects himself. V'ohava, and love her kigufo. I want to raise two questions here. Question number one, the Rambam changes his language from the Reisha to the Sefer, from one phrase to the other. When he addresses the question of love, he says kigufo, which means that his love for his wife is equal, but not greater than, his love for himself. And yet, when he addresses the question of kavod, of honor and respect, his respect for his wife exceeds beyond his respect for himself. Why is that? Question number two. When the Rambam says that his respect for his wife supersedes that of the respect for himself, again, let's read it inside. Shehe Adam mechabedet ishto yeter migufo. What practical difference does that? We call it the yeshiva world nafkin mina. Give me a nafkin mina. How do I respect my wife more than I respect myself? And this leads me to my third question, which is really hopefully going to stimulate your minds to answer the second question. It's Yontif time. And I have to respect my wife, correct? Here's a great opportune moment built into the Hebrew calendar year to respect my wife and let it express itself in concrete terms. And what's that? What do you say? Excellent. Close for Yontif, or alternatively, if not close, jewelry. Okay, helping her too. Maybe perfume. You know, again, I would recommend that he buy a perfume that he could tolerate. You know. So, let's say you have in your bank account set aside 100, whatever it is, like let's say 100 pounds sterling, so it'd be worth something, I guess. I don't know. You know, the yen is on its way down. So what would you do if you could buy one garment of clothing with that 100, and it would either be a dress or whatever for your wife, or it could be a suit for you. I mean, don't switch it around. That's not right. So, what would you do with that 100? Would you buy yourself a suit, or would you buy your wife something for Yontif? What's the answer to that question? Anybody know? Buy your wife something. Because the Rambam says, "Umechavda yeser migufo." Which means that in a choice situation, and you have to decide where the money is going to go, your first preference is to your wife. So that when the Rambam says Machabda Yesa Migufo, this has halachic implications. This is not just fancy talk. Okay. But when the Rambam gets to the level of Ahava, my level of Ahava, apparently, because the Rambam doesn't say V'Ohava Yosa Migufo, but Ohava Kigufo, why do you think that's so? Why did the Rambam drop the ball? You know, he was really leading me in a certain direction, and I have to put my wife on a pedestal, and she comes first. Why shouldn't my love for my wife be greater than my love for myself? Anybody?
It's not possible.
It's not possible. The Torah says, V'yahavta l'reicha kamocha. Halavai, if only we could reach that level of loving someone as much as we love ourselves. Again, this is not an approach that would be appropriate for masochists and sadists. You know, if somebody's down on themselves, then he's got to rewrite the pasuk here. Not kamocha, but yes, every kamocha. But for normal people, we are built, and that's how God created us, with a certain level of self-love. Again, we have to be careful that that self-love, narcissism, doesn't take over us to the point to which we can't love anyone else. You know, totally self-centered. In fact, I would submit to you that what the Rambam is telling us here, and I want to show that idea over and over again in the literature that I've copied for you tonight, is that the purpose and the framework of marriage is to take us out of this self-centered love. You know, when we're single people and we have no one to worry about except for ourselves, this develops within us certain character traits which are totally focused in a self-centered way on ourselves. We can call it three people: me, myself, and I. But it's always three that are one at the end of the day. So you can call it three, but it's one. Now we have to break out of that self-centered circle. The greatness of marriage is that you can reach a level of love for another person that's equal to the love that you have for yourself. So you're no longer worried about yourself and only yourself. Now it becomes me, myself, and her. Or maybe it's me and her. We should say it that way. And when it comes to kavod, how does this ava express itself in practical terms? Mechavda yoser migufo. Let's go on in the Rambam, because there's a lot more in this Rambam. The Rambam tells us the following. Lo yatil aleha ema yisera. Now watch this. The Rambam has in mind a vision in which a woman has a certain level of mora for her husband. And the Rambam is very concerned about mora which gets out of control. Let's translate the word mora into English. Can anyone offer me two different translations? And they're fundamentally different. And it's very tricky. Fear or?
Oh.
Or awe? I'd like to leave the word awe for God. We should be awe. You know, God is the awesome God. So let's start, you know, if you don't mind, I would like to water it down a drop here, you know. I'm going to call it reverence. Or, right, a certain kind of reverential respect. The Rambam says the following. A woman has to have respect for her husband. And we'll see that that's going to express itself in many different ways. Respect, yes. Fear, not. And that's why the Rambam says that a husband is responsible to go out of his way to guarantee that that mora should not take on extended or exaggerated dimensions in which it turns into ema yisera, this overall fear. Now, I don't even think the Rambam has in mind fear of physical brutality, what they call today, what do they call it? Abuse, right? I don't think that he's talking about physical abuse, but maybe he's talking about a psychological abuse. And the Rambam says, you know what? And this is the greatest challenge of marriage for a husband. The yeh diburo ima benachas. You know, it shouldn't be like Rabbi Berzon's lecture, you know, when he screams at you. No, that's not right in marriage. No screaming in marriage. No raising the voice. Now tell me, friends. Okay, so I didn't raise my voice. Big deal. So I deserve first prize. What does that indicate on a deeper level if I didn't raise my voice? If I speak benachas. Anyone?
You put her ego before yours.
And how do you do that? Is it easy? I wanted to ask you to take a test. You know, for the next 20 minutes of discussion with someone, make sure that you speak benachas. What does that require?
Patience.
Patience.
Effort.
Discipline. Effort. Focus. Imagine, a man is married to a woman, and in Mirz Hashem, they'll be married together for a lifetime. And the Rambam says, be careful never ever to raise your voice. You are in total self-control over the volume of your voice, but it's more than that. The Rambam used the word benachas. He's not just telling you, don't raise your voice, which might mean anger, emotions that take over and go beyond your control. The Rambam wants nachas. Nachas indicates a certain caressing, a certain intimacy, a certain caring about the next one. And then the Rambam says something that's unbelievable. And here's where I get a little emotional, because this hurts me, because it's very difficult to fulfill the next three words of the Rambam. The Rambam says, "Velo yeh atziv." Now look, if the Rambam wants to tell me not to get angry, that's hard enough. We all get angry at times. And that's the next two words in the Rambam, "Velo ragzon." But the Rambam goes beyond that. "Velo yeh atziv." How would you translate the word atziv?
Sad.
I'm depressed.
What do you say?
I'm not depressed. That's a better answer.
Depressed is too extreme here in this case. The Rambam doesn't even want you to be atzeh. In other words, if you would ask me, what are my goals for myself? And this would be true for someone who's married, someone who's not married. It would be to avoid depression, not to be sad in life. We all want to be, has the same breadth of, you know, besimcha, what does it say? What? Mitzvah gedol leos? Simcha tamid, right? But no. Now I'm in a marriage relationship. The Rambam's going way beyond that. The Rambam's not telling you something that's good and healthy for you. In your own Dalet Amos, Beino Leveinatzmo, me, myself, and I, make sure not to get sad. The Rambam is telling us that in the context of the interrelationship between a husband and wife, there's no tolerance, zero tolerance for being sad. Wow, that's asking a lot. You know, life throws a lot of curveballs at us, a lot of vicissitudes of life. You know, the waters go up and they go down, and the graph is jumping like an electrocardiograph machine, and I'm supposed to be low atzev. Because if I'm atzev, it's going to have an impact on my wife. And that's something that I can't allow to have. If somehow I have to be atzev, I don't know, lock myself up somewhere in ivory tower, but she doesn't have to know about it. Because it's going to drag her down. And then the Rambam says, "Velo ragzon." Do you notice something, if you're careful about the language of the Rambam, do you see a grammatical difference in the conjugation between atzev and ragzon?
He puts the rogez in the present?
No, I didn't mean that. In terms of the description, the adjective, lo yeh atzev, lo yeh ragzon. What's the difference between those two?
We have roges.
Oh, you have roges?
No, I don't have roges.
Oh, you have roges. What do you have?
Roges.
Oh, you have roges. Okay. Let me see if we... I don't know. We don't have time now. But some Rambams have rags on. I don't have the ability to check that out right now.
Which safer is it from...
There are different printings of the Rambam. In any event... Okay. Just 1 second. You know what? It might even fit into the word roges. Roges. I don't know. I'm not sure. I have to check the... Just give me 1 second here. I don't want to waste your time here. Practice Vav Halacha Yutes. Otherwise, I can just get up and get another Rambam. Test Vav. He says, "Tfus Venitia." Okay, this is the Italian printing of the Rambam, which is many, many centuries ago, Ubitfusim Acherim Ragzon. So again, I can't promise you which text is correct, but what's the difference between Otsev and Ragzon grammatically? And it could be Rogiz would also fit into what I'm going to say.
One's a state and one's a precipitation.
Exactly. One is the state of being, an emotional state, Otsev. It doesn't describe the person. It describes the state of mind, emotionally, that he's in. The other describes the person. Maybe the Rambam felt it was too much to ask of us, if you have accuracy in the Rambam, not to get angry. We get angry. That's a fact of life. That's part of, that's built into the human condition. But not to be a Ragzon, you know, someone who is quick-tempered, that's not something that's tolerant. Okay, my friends, that's as far as the man, the husband's responsibility in marriage. But, you know, marriage is a two-way street. Takes two to tango, right? So what's the woman's responsibility? Now, watch carefully how the Rambam shifts his language. And the Rambam says, V'chein tzivu chachom al isha, shetehe mechabedes es baila biyoser midai. Her kavod, her respect for her husband, knows no bounds. Again, he's got to work to deserve this. V'yelo aleha mora. And she should have, we would call it, a reverence for her husband. But look at the next requirement of the Rambam. V'tase kol maaseha al piv. And she should do everything that he would want her to do. V'yia be'eneha. And he should be in her eyes. The mosar o melech. Really look up to him. Ma'aleches. B'taivas libo, she tries to give whatever he desires to him to fufill his desire. Umerachekes kol sheyisna, and to push away that which is hateful in his eyes. Now, interesting. Does the Rambam require of a woman, of a married woman, that she should not be atzev, or I guess in the feminine atzeva? Or Ragzanit? How do I know the Rambam doesn't require that? Because he left it out. See, this is what our Rebbeim trained us to do. When we read a Rambam, we not only read what he does say, but we read also what he doesn't say. Very strange. This paradox, you know, woke me up out of my sleep. Like, why does the Rambam require of a husband that he should not be atzev? And yet he drops that when it comes to a woman, to a wife.
I would say that women are usually like stronger emotionally, and if a woman is angry at her husband, she can really destroy him.
Oh.
No, not destroy him, but you know what I mean. Like, I'm sorry. I think a woman can deal better with her husband being angry at her, as a husband can deal with his wife to be angry at him.
Meaning he has trouble to deal with it, you say, or what?
Yeah, and I think he needs her.
So if he has trouble, shouldn't the Rambam have mandated the wife to not to be in a state of atzmut, right? If the impact, the repercussions are so destructive, you know, then maybe the Rambam should have warned the woman not to be atzmut. I wanted to suggest something different, and that is that that's not feasible. You can't require for a woman not to be otzev. You know, a man is somehow emotionally detached, and maybe we can hope that he can control his emotion. But I don't know that a woman is expected, you know, to be in total control. You know, a woman before birth, a woman after birth. Women are emotionally more sensitive than men, which works both in favor of the female race and the opposite. You know, it's great for women, you know, to be emotional, and it really denies men of a whole world out there of emotions. But the drawback, the downside of it, is that a woman, Chazal tell us, that dim'asa krovola, that a woman is very close to tears more than a man. Now, watch this. This is a generality that always bears exceptions. You know, when my wife and I go see a movie, I start crying. She never does. So again, everything works in all different directions, you know. I stop reading books, you know, novels. I just can't take it, you know. It's like too much for me. You know? I could fill up the whole thing with tears, you know, with water. But most women, if you could say that, the Chazal say, are very close, you know, they're... they're emotionally more vulnerable. So to demand of a woman that she be in such control of her emotions that she never becomes otzev, maybe that's beyond reach. But in any event, we do see something very critical in this Rambam, and that is that the harmony of marriage requires this mutual respect in which he's going out of his way to respect his wife more than he respects himself. Her respect for him knows no bounds. There's a certain control in the marriage, which is interesting. You know, you get the sense he should be in total control of his emotions. She is also calculating, you know, what... This is not the romantic vision of Western culture in which, you know, everything goes. You know, just, you know, we just expose ourselves in every single way, emotionally, and in terms of the way we speak to each other. And the Rambam gives you a little bit more of a, you know, there's got to be a calculated nachas. There's almost a training period. And the Rambam doesn't say that this training period lasts for a month or 6 months or a year. You know, Shana Rishona, what we call. This is something that takes the couple through their lives. And maybe what the Rambam is trying to convey to us is don't take a good, happy marriage for granted. You know, Baruch Hashem, you've lived together for a decade, 2 decades, 5 decades. Don't let your guard down. These halachot, the Rambam form is codifying, apply equally to a couple that is celebrating their 70th wedding anniversary, which I just attended one the other day. As a couple, did you hear that? Nobody heard that. 70th wedding anniversary, you understand what I mean? You know, they're pushing 100, but that's okay. I mean, my friend Alistair was, he said Kaddish for his mother, who died at 105, and he says she was lucid till the last day. Well, maybe she's Canadian. You know, I always say survival of the fittest. Anyone who can live through those Canadian winters, you know, that's, they deserve to live to at least 100. You know what I'm saying? But be that as it may, this guard has to take us throughout. I want to call your attention to a book that I think is very, very profound and is worth reading. Yeah, we're not going to have time to go through the whole book. It's hundreds of pages long. I'll show you what it looks like. It's called Shnayim Shehem Echad, and it's written by a couple. This is a teamwork, classical marital harmony work of Yirmiyahu Utila Abramov. You may have heard of Ner Le'Elef. He's the head of that organization, Ner Le'Elef. And in the first piece on what's called Zivug Min HaShamayim, which is the concept that, you know, always haunts us. You know, what does this mean? Bashert. He begins, or she begins, actually she's writing the first part of the book because she's addressing the wife, by telling a story. And as we're reading the story, we're beginning to get the feeling that something very holy is going on over here. You know, Kedusha, a level of sanctity that goes perhaps even beyond our comprehension, but it perhaps gives us at least a vision of what marriage is all about. The story is as follows. I'm not going to read every word in the original here. I'll just translate as we go along. If you have it and you can follow along inside, that would be worth your while. A couple has been married for many, many years, and Kohev Halev, they have no children, and they come in front of the holy Tana, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, and ask him to arrange a divorce, because although they've been living together so happily in a wonderful marriage, a wonderful partnership relationship, but they want to have children, and he will go his way, hopefully marry a woman, have children, she will go hers and have children. And Rav Shimon Bar Yochai looks into their eyes very deeply, and he says, you know what? You're coming for a divorce. I will fulfill your request. But you know what? You got married with happiness. There was mishta, there was simcha. It was levedik. You know, they hired the best bands, and they took the best ulam smachot, you know. And it was a wedding that went down in the, you know, in the annals of Jewish history as one of the most wonderful, happy weddings. The dancing was intense. I think that before you get divorced, the divorce, like the wedding, should be mitoch, simcha, and mishta. And therefore, I demand of you as a prerequisite that you have a mishteh, a wonderful party, and then after the party, come to me and I'll arrange the divorce. And this came the phrase misibat gerushin. I don't know if you ever heard of it. I never heard of it. Anyway, so what happens? At this misibah, the husband stands up on 2 feet. And he says, my lovely wife. And he says this in front of Am Ve'eda, in front of the whole entourage. He says, you know what? You've been the most wonderful wife. I love you so much. And here, under these difficult circumstances, we have to separate. We have to go our own ways. I want you to remember our marriage, our lovely, harmonious marriage relationship for good, despite the fact that we're going to get divorced. And before you leave this house, I want you to choose some object in this house that you love, that you cherish, that you want for your own. And it's yours. And that will always be a remembrance, a memory of our lovely relationship. So the wife decides to plan a scheme. I don't know if you've already chaffed the punchline. And what she does is, he's holding a cup, you know, because at a mishta we drink wine, at Mitzvah Shem in another month's time or so we'll be doing that for Purim. This wasn't a Purim suit, this is a Gershon suit. And she sees to it that his goblet is never empty. So finally, the man is dead drunk. And she tells the servants in the house to pick him up and bring him bodily to her parents' house. Here we turn the page. He wakes up from his sleep and he realizes where he is, and he looks strangely at his wife, and she says to him, I did exactly what you told me to do. You asked me to choose one object that's so beloved to me that I don't want to part with. I chose that one object. I want you in my house. And the couple come back to Reb Shimon Bar Yochai and he prays on their behalf, and sure enough, a year later, they have a child. Now, the postscript to this story, I think, is very, very moving. If you take a look, again, it's like the fourth paragraph on the flip side of your page. It says, Bein im isha mudat lekach, bein im lav. Whether a woman is conscious, if she's aware of this or not, ha'otsar hayakar bioter sheyeshla, the greatest treasure that she has, and she may deny it, is her husband. And this story teaches us that even in the throes of a divorce, even when a couple, Nebuch, is about, chas v'shalom, to split, a woman who's clever and she loves, she's a person who has so much love, can still add a new ruach hachaim, a new spirit, into the marriage. And even at this late stage, when they're on the threshold of separating, livnot otam michadash, to rebuild that marriage. Now, as we study the topic of marital harmony, we'll always be juggling two questions. One question is how to inject love into the marriage relationship, how to keep it going and have it increase and get even better and better. And on the other hand, to answer the question, when is there no hope for the marriage at all? And in this context, one of the crucial concepts that's going to really have to be placed up front is bashert. And that is, and we all have to ask ourselves this question, and I'm speaking to the marrieds now, do we believe in bashert? When I say do we believe in bashert, what I mean to say is I've done my due diligence. You know, we went through all the references. She is who she is, I am who I am, you know, the husband is who he is. And everything is clear. But yet, despite it all, there's friction in the marriage. There's tension. There's not the nachas ruach that the Rambam speaks, l'daber le b'nachas, voices are being raised. Perhaps she doesn't recognize all his needs. And so tension arises. And then we ask ourselves the question of all questions. So what's the response? Is the response, let's throw in the towel? This is not what I bargained for. Or is the response, on the contrary, these are the challenges of marriage. God wants me to work this out. He put me into this marriage. I did everything I had to do. This woman is God-fearing. This woman is not, you know, in violation of any of the big five that we spoke about at the beginning of the class tonight. But there's tension. This is a challenge. How do I work this out? If you take a look at the bottom of your page, Vayivra Elokim es ha'odom b'tzalmo, this is a very deep, profound sentence. God created man in the image of himself, of his image. But then the pasuk says, Zachar unekeva bara otam. He did create two subspecies, if you will, two genders. There's Zachar and there's the Keva, there's he and she. But at the end he says, let's bring her to him, Vehayu lebasar echad, and they become one. Notice, what we have is two halves that make up a whole. But each half is unique, is different, is an individual. In a sense, it's like a puzzle. None of the pieces of the puzzle look identical. They're all different. They all have a different complexion. But we put them together and they form a whole. Vahayu lebasar echad. The challenge of marriage is to go from stage one to stage two. Stage one is Zachar unekeva bara osam. They are two individuals, fundamentally different. They come from different families, different upbringings, different emphases. They have different heredities. There's no way of marrying the same, you know, identical person to you unless you marry your Siamese twin. And the halacha doesn't allow that. And not only that, I have a feeling that even twins are radically different from each other. Those who have raised twins, I think, will agree with me. So then, by definition, marriage means Zachar Unakeva. It means two different individuals with two different ways of looking at life, different ashkafot, different personality traits, but yet Vahayu Lebasar Echad. And therefore they have to come to be one. So much so that the Gemara tells us that the word Adam, which means a complete man, is designated specifically for a married man. And a person who's not married is not called Adam, because he's living within his own self, developing his own personality, his own traits, his own attributes. He's not up against a conflict situation which forces him to refine and transform himself. And then he's not an Adam. The Adam, who's perfect, is the person who has the capacity to develop. The word Adam, says the Maharal Miprag on the bottom right side of your page, comes from the word, it's the root word of Adama. Adama means the ground from which man came. He says, La Adama yesh koch latzmiach, dvarim shebetocha. A man also has in potential, every one of us, insofar as we're created as an Adam, the potential to grow and to develop. However, man, as opposed to any other creature, requires a situation of breaking out of himself, creating this Vahayu Levasar Echad, this harmony, in order to reach his fruition, to maximize his or her capacity as Adama. And therefore, the Torah declares, Lo Tov Heyot Adam Levado. Now what does this mean, Lo Tov Heyot Adam Levado? This pasuk has to be understood on two different levels. My Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik points out, and this goes back to Chazal, that there is what I would call, at least at the face of it, a discrepancy between the first chapter of Bereshit and the second chapter of Bereshit. In which, in these two chapters respectively, the Torah describes the creation of woman totally differently. In chapter 1, Zachar Unekeva Bara Osam, God creates man and woman, male and female, simultaneously. In chapter 2, only Adam, male, is there, and God puts male into a deep sleep, Lutar Deima, and then takes a part of man's flesh and creates woman and brings woman to man. So I don't know if you're all familiar with Rav Soloveitchik's writings. One of his most famous essays is called The Lonely Man of Faith. How many, just by show of hands, how many people have ever heard of it? No one? Oh, a few, good. Ah, I'm glad, a few people. Okay, I have a copy, but God knows where it is. You know, I can think of 15 different possible places because I'm all spread out these days. Different continents, different countries, everything. In any event, in The Lowly Man of Faith, the Rav says, and here he's fighting against what they call the biblical critics, you know, that chapter 1 of Bereishit was written by one person, chapter, I don't even want to mention the Apikorsis here, but the Rav says that there's Adam the first, Adam the second. These are two definitions of the relationship between husband and wife, between male and female. On the first relationship, lo tov heyos adam levadom, means that man alone can't do it. Robinson Crusoe is a product of fiction. It doesn't exist in the real world. There are so many things that challenge us in the physical universe. We are in a state of insecurity. We need to create a community. The first community was male and female, that marriage, kihilah, that is a relationship in which lo tov heyos tovim ashnayim in echad, they work together as a unit, they complement each other, they face the challenges of life together. It's like, you know, a boat, a ship at sea, and there's a storm, and we need to get together the whole unit of all the people on the, you know, on the staff, and work together. That's what marriage is at this level. Marriage is pragmatic. Marriage is utilitarian, it's functional, it enables man to face the challenges of life. But, says the Rav, at this level, lo tov heyos adam levadom, is superficial. And then there's Adam the second, as he calls it. Adam the second is the lonely man who's created alone. Loneliness is not a psychological state. Loneliness is an existential state. A person could be, for anyone who knows New York, on New Year's Eve at Times Square when the ball is about to come down, he's surrounded by who knows how many hundreds of thousands, about millions of people, and he feels total loneliness. He's totally alienated, alone, separate. Loneliness as an existential concept or category describes man as being unique, as being different, and therefore alien to others. At this stage, man, lo tov heyos adam, cannot tolerate. He can't exist alone. He's got to break out of his loneliness. Very often, young people ask the question, when? When am I ready to start dating? And at one level, we can answer them from Adam the first perspective. They need a wife for reasons X, Y, and Z. But on a deeper level, they see in themselves a state of loneliness that has to be completely uprooted and undermined. That has to be changed. The existential oneness of marriage from the level of Adam the second is v'hayu lebasar echad. They're existentially one personality. They work together. They pray together. They create a community in which they invite the Shekhinah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, enters into this community. At this level, marriage reaches its apex. It's really a oneness that transcends beyond just utilitarian and functional oneness and marriage. All right. I see I stretched it a little. I apologize. I'll stop here. If anyone wants to stay for questions, please do. And B'li Neder, with your bracha, we'll continue this next week, because I feel like we're getting somewhere, but we're not there. Take home these pages, look them over. For those of you who feel more comfortable in reading English than Ivrit, I have for you a number of pages from a book, which we photocopied. Of course, I thought I had the book on my table. I probably left it in the photocopy machine, which is called The Kettle and the
Bird.
Okay, we're not going to go through the whole book. It's a couple of, well, it's 100 pages at least. But I'd like you to look. Oh, here it is.